you want to just pick out the component of the field and you're in the thermodynamic limit, then you will see that I'm going to sit here. The question is, if the limit of this expectation value of H, if the limit is equal to if I go H down to zero and it has a non-zero limit, then I'll get the expectation value of phi. H was a constant external field, so I'm just going to, so what I'm going to put in is I am going to look at box plus m squared phi a is equal to h. These become the effective equations of motion of the system. All of the loop corrections are encoded in here, and this is what, if I had looked at the expectation value of box phi plus r phi rb phi a plus lambda over 6 n, which is my g, squared by a. If I look at this quantity in this large n limit, it takes this form because these phi squared comes out. I'm looking at h a being constant. I've not broken translation invariance or any of the symmetries of the system as far as space-time symmetries are concerned. Phi a is a constant. The expectation value of H is, of phi A is going to be constant since H A was a constant. I'm just left with the expectation value of phi squared. So I'm left with M squared phi is equal to zero, H A. One can obtain these by more careful analysis. So when H is equal to zero, this implies that phi A equals zero or M squared equals zero. So these are my Goldstone modes. So phi A is zero in the symmetric phase of the theory. And when M squared will go to zero, I will get phi A being non-zero. So the new phase but M squared has to respond to the parameters of the theory. So I have to be able to access M squared equals zero. That's what will happen. So let's just look at what this is. Let's look at three dimensions first of all. Oops, I meant to keep this. I was going to organize my... So let's look at... D equals 3. So what is it? In D equals 3, yeah? And M, G of X. A times R. And R is my space-time interval r is equal to the square root of x squared minus, and if you want I epsilon prescriptions in here, you get the Feynman-Greene's function. So I want to obtain this diagram, and you see what I've done here is I'm taking the two points as close together as I possibly can. So this is the expectation value of phi at x and phi at zero. And you can just deal with the symmetric one as the simplest thing, or whichever Green's function you want. It's not a big issue at this point. So this quantity here, as x goes to zero, I will pick up from the operator product expansion, I'm going to pick up phi, expectation value of phi squared. So if we look at expanding this around r equals zero, we get 1 over 4 pi r, let's think of it as our min, the minimum distance we can go to, plus, minus m over 4 pi. And we are left with, so if I replace our min as being equal to something like lambda to the minus 1, my inverse cutoff, the theory has divergences because it has ultraviolet divergences, but we're in three dimensions, so the only ultraviolet divergences are the tadpole, and those are rather trivial. They give rise to a shift. This is my divergence. So we see that if I define RB is equal to minus 1 over 4 pi R min plus T, then I can cancel this divergence. So I'm defining my renormalized quantity. There's just the shift renormalization, which is usually dealt with by normal ordering, or the operator product expansion, which I'm doing here. We are left with the spherical constraint. Spherical constraint becomes T plus, since I don't need to renormalize my coupling, I will get a minus G times M over 4 pi is equal to M squared. So we see now that we have M squared, M of T is equal to times minus 1 plus T. So this is the response of the thing. In statistical mechanics, people often consider T, note, first of all, that T equals 0. So at T equals 0, we have M equal to 0. So this is the massless. And now, so if I take T less than 0, what do we get? I wrote out my spherical constraint. So T is less than 0. I have T plus, my diagram is 0. So there's a G. So phi is equal to, modify is equal to the minus T over So the phase diagram. Simply, as the function of T, we have a phi which grows as T minus TC in this statistical mechanics language is equal to TC minus T mod of this over G to the 1/2. And we get a beta is the critical exponent. So this is, that's what the solution to the model was. There was one other part that I wanted to point out. It's that if I take G goes to infinity here, which I'm allowed to do, since I've solved the model exactly, this term, I'm going to get a universal answer. And that corresponds to expanding in renormalization group terms around the Wilson-Fisher-Biggs point of this model. So sitting at the fixed point corresponds to sitting T to be zero, but one can access universal quantities by sending G to infinity in general. I'm sending my bare coupling to infinity, and in the statistical setting, one normally thinks of a coupling constant. G is dimensionful in three dimensions as coming in with the scale of the microscopic physics. So that's a very natural thing to do. That's just a side comment. I'm going a little slower than I expected, so let me go and describe what happens at, just write down what d equals 4. So in d equals 4, the Green's function is 1 over 4 pi squared x squared times, so there's an m, k1 of m times x. And again, this is your space-time interval. We're interested in the tadpole, this quantity, and it's going to be, now we're going to get a 1 over 4 pi squared x min. Minus m squared over 16 pi squared log of m squared over lambda squared plus this 2 gamma minus 1. This is what it works out to be. Sorry, I should have taken this x over 4 times x min. Sorry. This is what it looks like. And again, I put in x min. Just to make it simpler, I will take x min squared over 4 to be equal to lambda to minus 1. So one gets this one here is equal to 1 over 4 pi squared, or 16 pi, so 16 pi lambda squared minus m squared over 16 pi squared log of m squared lambda squared. Now I should write down my spherical constraint and renormalize it. My spherical constraint is RB plus GB times this quantity. Or log m squared. So let me, for convenience, I will just divide it through by GB, and I'll get a GB here. And now you see that if I define 1 over GB to be equal to 1 over G at mu, get the signs right. There's a minus m squared over 16 pi squared log of mu squared over lambda squared. I remove my cutoff, and I should define RB over GB to be an invariant. In other words, I renormalize RB plus GB. Again, I take this quantity in here and dress RB with it. So I get some of these two is going to be my TB over GB, which I'll call tau. And if I do this, I'm left with a renormalized expression. You can check that the beta function for G is equal to G squared over 8 pi squared, which you would compute by loop standard analysis. So the theory is renormalized. You can again see that aside from renormalization effects, it's qualitatively the same as the three-dimensional case. Three-dimensional case is just a little bit cleaner to deal with, but there's no complication. And that's the full renormalization of the theory. As you know, phi 4 with n components is renormalizable. So this is the renormalization that's necessary in this case. And it...
You don't have any phase transition, right?
In D equals 2, you don't have any phase transition.
And I say because I think isn't that going to be somewhat similar to the problem you're going to have in the center?
The question you can add, yes. It's going to be more severe than that. But let me move quickly through what happens. I realize I'm going very slow here. At finite temperature, because there's an analogy between finite temperature and de Sitter, one can write down the solutions again. The technique is the same. You can use Euclidean theory, and it's equivalent to R to the D minus 1 cross S1. And you can do a mode sum. If I do it in, one can easily solve it in D equals 3, just to show you what happens. D equals 3, one gets a... the tau plus, and now let me take G goes to infinity, just to simplify things. Tau is equal to, m squared over G minus, it was m over G. So I'm just going to take tau m goes to infinity. Tau goes to infinity. I get an m over 4 pi minus the log of 1 minus e to the minus m over t. So this is sufficient to illustrate the comment you were making. So now as tau, if I plot this quantity here on the right, m goes to 0 for tau goes to minus infinity. So there's no... there's no phase transition in this case, which is correct. What you expect, we have there are too many of them. If I look at D between 4 and 3, it's instructive just because it's sufficiently simple. What you get is that tau is equal to tau plus some number of over t to the d minus 2 is equal to a function of m and t, or 1 over t to the d minus 2 times a function of m over t. And this function, it interpolates between m between x to the d minus 2 and x to the d minus 3. So at large temperatures, I've probably written it. I should have probably pulled out an A, I should have pulled out an M, sorry. So it interpolates between one and and 1 over x. So there's vector dimensional reduction as we go there. But now we can look at where the transition happens. We can ask TC, suppose tau is less than 0. So we're sitting in the broken phase. T equals 0. As we, this num quantity here is positive. And you see that at a finite temperature, at TC, there is a, the model has a phase transition. I'll just put it here. It's equal to minus tau over B of D. Okay, so that's what happens at finite temperature.
Temperature D4T, how did you avoid the so the theorem, right, there's no phase transition is because there's no in D equal D4T, 2 plus 1?
In 2 plus 1, there is no problem. This model does, of course, have a phase transition.
No, but, okay, sorry. So it doesn't have it at finite temperature, but somehow it has
it. At finite temperature, it doesn't have. There is, at low temperature, at, it, it has a its transition is at zero temperature. If you wish. When you go down to below zero temperature, the Goldstone modes are sufficiently strongly interacting that the system has no longer has a phase transition. The point is that what does a phase transition mean? It means that I have to go down to, I'm in equilibrium, I'm waiting forever if I need to, so that the thing thermalizes, I have to go to zero mass. Zero mass means that from an R2 cross S1 point of view, S1 is invisible. I've gone to Compton wavelengths that are so large in comparison with the temperature that it looks like a two-dimensional system. So that's why there are no holes. There is no transition in this case. That's the right physics. So let me, I want to quickly move on to the Sitter space. So in De Sitter space, so probably to this audience, I don't even need to describe it very, but for completeness, let me take a couple of minutes to describe it. And let me give you a couple of references. Just in case. Well, it was considered by Dirac in 35, Gerze and Lee in 63, so there's an enormous literature. Various people, but then there's a rather nice paper by Allen in PhysRev D32, and it's 1985, and it's 3136. You can look up Spalding. And this one is it's a 7 at the end. And then there are this is 1015327 and Holland was 1010 by 367. So the point about De Sitter space is, and the most natural way of looking at it is to think of it as a hyperboloid in R D in Minkowski, I should call it. Minkowski D plus 1. And so we have x minus x naught squared plus is equal to some L squared. And if you choose nice global coordinate system on it, this one will get x naught is equal to tau xi is equal to omega I. Then one will induce the metric. The s squared is equal to minus d tau squared, half squared of tau d omega of d minus 1. So you see this, that what it has is it has spatial sections that are s d minus 1, and it has an expansion, an exponential contraction, an exponential expansion. The light cones go something like this. If I use a conformal pattern, let me go back here and try. It has all of the symmetries of Minkowski space, and as L goes to 0, becomes Minkowski space. It's a group contraction, which is one of the things that Gorsev would have been interested in. So if I draw the conformal diagram for it, it's instructive. So we get scry minus, scry plus. And just to, I'll put the north pole here and the south pole here. And let me draw in horizon. So this region here is the region which can influence the south pole. And this is the region that the south pole can influence. So as you see, the only influence of the north pole on the south pole is that scry minus or scry plus, which are my partly that I'm going to have to put in some initial influence for them to influence one another. And they will only influence it on scry plus. This is the horizon of the system, of the classical horizon of this sort of space. So a nice way of drawing this is to, sometimes it's nice to just double it, so that if I'm going to Euclidean space, what one does is one contracts this down, this light cone down, and identifies them. And the Euclidean version is SD. So many people will think of it as the sphere in D dimensions. Now, if I want to solve my model on this case, I have broken none of the symmetries of De Sitter space. So the expectation value phi squared is a constant. No reason to believe that it won't be. If I'm looking for a De Sitter invariant solution to the problem, so, and this corresponds to a De Sitter invariant quantization of the system. These guys argue that there's the no hair theorem, and one should have De Sitter invariance at late times, no matter what happens. So this is going to be a constant, and again, it's going to be equal to this diagram plus y. So now we want to evaluate our Green's functions. The problem amounts to evaluating Green's functions in De Sitter space. Again, that's a rather straightforward thing, and the solutions date back to the 60s. And if I just consider G again. Now, if I think of it in terms of X and Y, it's the Green's function is It depends only on my global distance, my geodetic interval, and one can write it, it's the solution, the hypergeometric. I will write the hypergeometric equation because it's useful. So this is box. Again, we're going to have, because of the same argument, we're going to have box plus m squared. Phi a is equal to 0. And we're going to look for m squared equals 0 will be the location of the transition. But now we're in De Sitter space. So we have my Green's function is a solution to my... Just copy it, it's the easiest thing. It's 1 minus p squared d2 by dp2 plus or minus d times p d by dp of plus m squared l squared acting on g is equal to 0 as well, aside from singularities. So note that there's a symmetry. The solution to this is g of p, and g of minus p is an equally solution. Minus p is the antipode. So the antipode, if I go here, I'm just taking something, and this is point here, has an antipode. On the equator, on my sphere, it's the antipode of the sphere, on my spatial sections. Do I have 5 or 6 more minutes? Okay. So the solution to this problem is a 2F. 1 of d over 2 and 1 plus p over 2. This is the Green's function. If I put this in, I evaluate my diagram again. P is cosine of the distance over L. I can easily evaluate it. And it's going to go like 1 over 4 pi, and d is equal to 3, for instance. It has an especially simple form in terms of cosines and sines. And one gets 1 over 4 pi d plus, let me just write out the form here. It's minus square root of 1 minus, let me take it, call it x, m squared l squared, I'll just call it x here, times cot square root of pi, square root of 1 minus x, over 4 pi l. If you look at, as x goes to 0, this goes to 1 over 2 pi m squared. So again, if we look at our spherical constraint, is the distance? Yeah, it's the distance radius, exactly.
Four pi little d or 1 over 4 pi big d, or
it's 1 over 4 pi little d.
So it's just 12 pi.
Sorry, no. This is in 3 dimension. I was calling it capital D. Sorry, okay. It's my distance. So it's 1 over 4 pi d, which is again my divergence. This is
the divergence. So you introduce a minimal distance, do exactly the same thing. This coincides with Minkowski space. If I send elbows to infinity, I will obviously recover the Minkowski result. This part here, of course, doesn't care whether I've done it in Minkowski space or Euclidean space, because it's independent of the interval. So this is the answer to my renormalized headpole. So the full equation is that tau plus g phi squared minus square root of 1 minus x over times L minus this cos pi square root of 1 minus x over 4 pi L. Alright, multiplied by L is equal to m times L. And phi is equal to 0 unless n is equal to 0. So we just need to look at this is tau times L is equal to plus this quantity. What we saw for small L, for small x, this goes like 1 over 4 pi. This goes now like 1 over 2 pi minus 2 pi. M times M squared. M squared L cube L cubed. Times M squared. But this is the Euclidean one. So as I've got a minus sign with this, so it maps out, if you plot it, it maps out the entire, it goes from minus infinity, it ranges from minus infinity to infinity. So there is no phase transition if I use this. So this is the standard solution. And this is the solution in the Bunch Davies. I'm going to skip the renormalization part. The renormalization is rather straightforward. It goes more or less exactly the same as in flat space, except that what is renormalized is the deviation from conformal coupling. I had a choice to put in to add to this a tau plus xc. I could have taken my tau to be tau t is equal to plot. I could add it xc r over xc r, and what gets renormalized is xc minus 1/6. And it has the same renormalization as t bear. But all of this is relatively obvious from the literature. So. So now the question is that the right physics of this system? And I would claim that it's not. That this is not an S3, this three-dimensional de Sitter space, it's an infinite-dimensional space. Even if you argued it was, the four-dimensional case has exactly the same structure, you get a 1 over S4. And the origin of it, as you can see, is if I write down the propagator in Euclidean space, it's a mode sum. And the mode sum is a discrete sum. As I go to 0, I'm reducing effectively to 0 dimensions. It's the right statistical physics on S4. This is correct statistical physics on S4. That's exactly what you would expect. I'm dealing with a finite volume situation. In finite volume, I never reach equilibrium. I have infrared divergences. Infrared divergences effectively mean that the mass... They're not real infrared divergences. They just mean that the mass of the theory never gets down to zero. It has finite size corrections. It has a minimum mass. and you can tune it down to minus and down towards zero by going to extreme values of the parameter space. The question is that the right physics in De Sitter space? And I would say the end, no, it's not. De Sitter space has this causal structure. I can find an alternative Green's function here by putting not one singularity, but I can add g of p plus g of minus p. I can leave a g of p plus b g of minus p. This, of course, has been considered before. And this is, if I relate a and b to Bogle-Yubov transformation of my Bunch-Davies vacuum, I get precisely this structure. And for real values, what you get is you get a cosh of 2 alpha and times g of p plus a sine of 2 alpha times g of minus p. Now, this has a pole at the origin and a pole at the antipode. However, this structure here, if I take it from this Bogle-Yubov transformation, does not satisfy the Hadamard condition. If I look at my pole structure here, I'm going to pick up the only singularity when p is going to 0, when p is going to 1. I'm going to the short distance behavior. I'm going to pick up this cosh 2 alpha. That's not reasonable. However, this problem here, well, it has any linear solution is a solution to this. I can put a and b whatever I wish. I don't need them to be come from a Bogle-Yubov transformation. So let's see what happens if I say I use this structure here. This g of p, yeah? And I look at its short distance behavior. Yes.
Maybe I'm missing something. Is what you're saying different than what you would say if you just did a free scalar field in De Sitter space?
Free-massive scalar field.
Yeah, free-massive scalar. I mean, you have basically the same equation.
It is only mildly different in that the massless scalar field, you give it whatever mass it has, it doesn't respond to the fact that it is in De Sitter space. In the same way that this model has a phase transition. I'm interested in the question, should there be a phase transition in De Sitter space, in three-dimensional and four-dimensional De Sitter space? Should I be able to access the neighborhood of that phase transition?
Okay, but you would still agree that you should just use the ordinary Euclidean vacuum propagator
for
very massive field?
No, I disagree.
You disagree.
I disagree.
Why do you want a phase transition in the center?
Because I believe it's the right physics there.
Okay. But I mean, it's like, if you can
I have an operator. So now the point here is that if I include A and B, I have no choice for A if I want Hadamard. A is 1. That governs the pole structure, short distance physics, I have G of P is this. If I look at the structure here, there's a constant in front of this.
Does Hadamard just mean you want it to reduce to the flat space limit?
Essentially.
So this then won't, what you're going to say, won't be from any perturbative vacuum. You're just going to modify the Green's function without...
No, you can track it back to a vacuum, but it won't be a Bogle-Yubov transform of the Bunch-Davies vacuum. It would be its own vacuum. The answer here is that B is equal to minus 1. So you have exactly a Green's function with pole at the origin and a Green's function with pole at at the antipode. Otherwise, these singularities won't cancel. Those infinite singularities won't cancel. However, if I do put in a pole, if I choose the Green's function that I'm interested in, to be precisely
the Bunch-Davies Green's function. So the Green's function G0 minus Fp minus G of minus P, then it solves the problem. What are the problems?
Thus, this is what Polyakov wants to use, and among other things, now you're going to have an imaginary part to one loop effective action.
No, but this is the... I didn't actually appreciate that this is what Polyakov wants to use.
That's
wants to use precisely in minus.
It's the only propagator where you're going to cancel the infrared divergence.
This is true.
Yes.
Okay.
But, so it's the only, yes, the only one. It's the one you get from doing analytic continuation from Euclidean idea into the sitter space.
But it's surely the correct one.
Well, except that it causes many other problems.
No,
it depends on what you want to do. I mean, if you want to start with this propagator, it's fine, but it's going to be, you're going to have...
The argument here is in the context of this model. Do I think that this model, do I think that in an infinite space-time, with arbitrarily small cosmological constants, I can never really have a true phase transition, that I can never reach the equilibrium state. I've never needed to break the sitter invariance. I would say, you know, the answer is one can. The arguments, if you look at the arguments of which they know here, all they use is the sitter, they establish is that you approach the sitter invariance. You don't approach necessarily Bunch-Davies. They put in Bunch-Davies. But if you put in this one, this Green's function, you approach this state. So, the point here is that for an interacting theory, I can sit at the parameter values which are precisely a massless state.
Yes.
So that I get m equals 0 by tuning tau. Yeah, sorry.
This is the only one where you're gonna be able to define. I mean, the reason why there's no fixed position in Bunch-Davies is just the same as in the equal tree. There's no ghost in place.
No, it's not.
There's no massless field.
No. But now there is a massless field here.
Well, yeah, but this
you
is
have a massless field.
So I'm just saying in Bunch-Davies, the reason why there's no fixed transition is because there's a massless field, and with a Bunch-Davies vacuum in any dimension that does not exist. So there's no fixed transition in Bunch-Davies.
Yes.
If you choose this one, then it's true that you have a phase transition, and you also have an S-matrix, but potentially.
Yes.
And also the good things.
And I also have something that looks qualitatively the same as finite temperature physics.
It's a fun model.
This Green's function, isn't it singular at non-coincident
points?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's singular at antipodal points.
Yes.
However, as you see, suppose I put the singularity, I'm going to sit at the south pole. Since any pole point is equivalent to any other, I'm going to define my location as the south pole.
Mm-hmm.
This is my traverse. This is how I traverse through time. I traverse all the way up along here, described thus. There's another singularity over here, but you don't see it. It never. The only point. There's only one point at past infinity. And at future infinity, that past infinity point can only influence it here. But that's a mathematical abstraction.
You think it's the right physics of the sitter space that if we do something over here, it's going to make a singularity over at the opposite pole?
No,
what's the question about a closed universe?
Yes, absolutely, I do. Because let us take the Gedanken experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Let me consider putting a massless scalar field into an inflating universe, which is going to inflate forever. It doesn't start inflating, but it's precisely massless.
Huh?
It has no choice. It cannot, it exists, this model exists in that setting. I choose the parameter values, but I choose the initial conditions not to be something that relaxes into the sitter space. The model has no option of choosing the Bunch-Davies vacuum. But it has a sitter invariant option. And all that it's saying is that at late times, the initial conditions effectively look like they've relaxed onto something that apparently has a mirror at the other side of the horizon. The horizon, if you were to solve it analytically, you would think it has a mirror with a negative charge at my antipode. Why is that so strange?
Well, one reason why you might think it's strange is that you could study a situation. You could study this model in a system that was de Sitter for a while and then exited into some sort of you know open FRW or something. Or,
like,
you know,
real life.
Yeah, real life. I mean, you could study real cosmology, and then I think the singularity would actually come back into the horizon. You would actually see it, right? I mean. Yeah, I mean, it's not just a philosophical abstraction. You know, if you compute the early universe, the physics of the early universe, you know, you start, you know, the density perturbations using
the singularity will never come back in.
I think it will.
It all it will affect is the boundary conditions. You will have set up things.
You inflate in a closed universe, and then inflation ends.
Yeah.
And then the horizon size increases, and eventually, well, at least you could imagine, it's a small perturbation of our real universe.
Yeah.
Eventually, you could see that whole sphere, and you would see this antipodal.
No, wait a minute.
No.
The antipode is not.
The antipode goes back to minus infinity.
It's not the spatial sphere.
It's not the spatial sphere.
It's space time. So this antipode is before any of this started.
Exactly.
No, but the singularity propagates. That singularity is all along the diagonal line of the square. In the Penrose diagram, it goes all the way up.
Sorry?
So say that you're on the right-hand side of that square, right?
Yes.
That's how you've been doing things?
Yes.
Okay, so then there's a singularity that starts in the lower left-hand corner, and it goes up the diagonal, and it hits the upper corner.
No, it starts on the opposite side. It's a rotated diamond within the square, singularities.
The singularity, this picture is easier to see what the singularity is. What is here, my singularity is down here. It's at the antipode. So I'm not in your inflationary scenario, you are up here. You're always up here. My singularity is down here. Always in the past of this. It's at the antipode. Not at future time. It appears to go backwards in time, not forwards in time.
But you say it doesn't approach Punch Davies at
it approaches, if I'm looking at, there's a global question, and there's a local question. If I am looking at this here, and this is the effect of renormalization. What I'm looking at is the effect of renormalization. It's the effect of the infrared divergences, or so-called divergences. The infrared divergences are controlled in this model. There is an exact solution. You don't have to, they are not divergences. They are what they are. You get, and they give finite values. You put in a finite broken symmetry phase in Minkowski space, you get a finite mass. And the value, you can evaluate what it is. No ambiguity. So what you see here in this part is you see a massive propagator, looks quite innocuous. You expand it. It looks, I can find out what the expansion is. Unless you approach this one, only when you go in and approach this singularity do you see that it has also that. But if I never physically enter there, then it's not a question.
Okay, but the other answer is, you see, there is an imaginary part to the one you have to mention in the business game.
Not here.
I think there is. I'm just grabbing mimicking.
Which do you mean? I don't see it.
Okay. So I think that's more of a problem than the interpolar point.
I don't see an imaginary part here. I can formulate this as in a slightly more mathematical language. And what I'm doing is I'm taking the Sitter space.
Okay, see that. Yes. Okay.
And I'm folding it on its horizon. And I'm considering, in this model here, I'm considering a Z2 bundle over that folded space. So it's. But I'm choosing the negative, the Z2 that corresponds to Kant, that allows Kant, I'm choosing the one that doesn't. That's what I'm doing here. I don't want to suggest that that is what the right treatment of this is, because there is nothing to suggest that there's anything wrong with spin 1/2 particles, spin 1 particles. This is a problem for scalars.
But, I guess, is it really a problem? Because it's not inconsistent. Nothing wrong. I mean, if you can have a phase transition, that's a laser. That's fine.
Yes, no, no. What about, and I would say the physics that I've treated here, and the one that I've answered to Bunch Davis, is the correct statistical physics of S4. Absolutely. It's the correct statistical physics.
It's not logically inconsistent on its own.
Sorry?
It's not logically inconsistent.
No, it's not logically inconsistent. It's a matter of physics. This is not logically inconsistent either. It's a matter of physics, and it's a matter of the correct boundary conditions to choose, and what will be chosen. And the point here is that what is natural to do is to look at the massless scalar field, which doesn't exist, strictly massless. One can put in the parameter values here and solve this model in a more dynamical space-time. It's not an insurmountable problem, it's just a technical problem.
I want to come back to this question of singularities. So, as Ben was pointing out, if you have the center space and then it exits, then it seems that you're able to see directly the correlations of the field and on the whole the waste of the center space. So you'd be able to see that the field on one side was highly correlated with the field on the other side. Do you agree with that?
That the field was highly correlated.
So, for example, the correlation, this two-point function you wrote down, if one of the fields is at halfway up on the south pole, then the singularities are going to be along a square which has been rotated by 45 degrees inside that diagram. So then, if now you suppose that the center space exits, so that at late times an observer is able to look back in their backwards light cone and see both of these poles, so they'll see that the field on one side was highly correlated with the field on the other side.
I don't think so. I don't believe so.
Wait, which part?
You will see that it's highly correlated. The question is, how are you going to exit?
Well, you our universe.
The usual scenario is you exit by making a hole here.
Wait.
Got a new vacuum.
You don't want to do that.
No.
Just study this theory on a potential with some slow roll inflation that relaxes to zero. Okay?
So then the
whole space on global slices will gradually roll down the hill. And then sort of asymptote to zero CC with some infinite amount of conformal time. It may crash. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I don't see that it would be natural to have the entire.
That's what slow roll inflation is.
Slow roll inflation is
a De Sitter phase that starts from some finite spatial thing.
You have to have global De Sitter. I don't see why you have to have global De Sitter.
I didn't say you have global De Sitter. What I said is slow roll inflation describes a finite spatial region that has a De Sitter phase for some finite amount of
time.
I
appreciate that.
Exits. And we could, for example, take it to start on a three sphere. That's a completely natural thing.
Yes, I mean, the point is, this is predicated on the assumption that I have to sit it forever. So these singularities will not be true singularities. If I'm not really in the sitter, if I mess it up, I can distort this into something that's focusing but not singular.
One way you try and define infinite de sitter is as a limit of a de sitter that exits. That helps resolve some of the confusions.
I think you guys have found the intuition from slow roll inflation to a propagator that's so far off from Bunch Davis.
It is not so far off from Bunch Davis. If I expand it out, to a large extent, it just almost differs by a constant from Bunch Davis.
No, for the momentum, it goes instead of going 1 over k cubed, it goes 1 over k.
It's huge.
I mean, you won't get a k invariance, but you will not. It also has a k invariance, but anyway.
If I look at it in position space, and I look at it out to large distances, it has a series expansion. And what happens is that if I'm looking at it here, the hypergeometric function, you have to expand it
And then you're on the antibody P,
as it depends on G of 1 minus P. And the hypergeometric function at 1 is just 1. So it has no singularity if I'm expanding around my universe. It has no singularity. So it just has this constant correction to all intents and purposes from the Bunch Davies vacuum. As you
maybe we should keep it, then you want to have the last word and then we'll go downstairs and have some tea or
sure, no, that's fine. This is the model. I think people appreciate the model, and it's exactly so. One can do much more with it. Was the main thing. It was. It's a suggestion for filling it. Apparently, I was checking Polyakov because I didn't appreciate that he.
Yeah, but that's a normal.
I haven't read all of the. I've been trying to read some of this literature. And this model addresses the infrared singularities in a controlled fashion, which is one of the reasons we're looking at it. Excellent.